This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Anthony Brooks in Washington. There's a growing number of Americans, some 20 million right now, who do at least some of their work at home. We're not just talking about telecommuters who work for companies that give them the flexibility to work from home. We're also talking about a new untethered workforce made up of contract workers, consultants, and freelancers. Thanks to cell phones and broadband, they have flexible schedules, and their homes are also their offices. But here's the challenge. Those who can work this way and can afford to work this way often lead pretty comfortable lives. But for many others, health insurance is expensive, retirement benefits non-existent, which can make life precarious. So the question this hour is, with so many Americans now working independently, is it time to consider a proposal from Matt Bai of the New York Times Magazine? He calls this an historic opportunity to create a more enlightened notion of work, and he asks if it's time to rewrite the social contract between worker, companies, and the government. Later in the hour, a new study on children and ADHD. But first, the new American worker, untethered and unplugged. If you work from home, if you're part of this new breed of independent worker, tell us your story. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can also comment on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we're joined here in Washington by Matt Bai, who covers politics for the New York Times Magazine. His piece, Home Office Politics, ran two Sundays ago. And welcome back to Talk of the Nation, Matt.
Hey, Anthony. Nice to be here.
Yeah, good to have you. First of all, let's be clear about who you're talking about. Give us a sense of who makes up this modern, untethered American workforce that you're writing about.
Well, there's actually not a great deal of data about it, and people don't spend a lot of time studying it. So no one can tell you with any exactitude, and there are people who can give you statistics better than I can. The census data would tell you that there are some 4 million people working exclusively at home, and more than 20 million doing it some part-time. And, they are, by and large, people who have a marketable intellectual skill set of one kind or another that enables them to be very mobile. And the onset of all this new technology from BlackBerries and cell phones and internet, video conferencing, which is getting real big, enables people to be very flexible in their schedule. You know, there are usually a few questions people ask when the subject comes up. And one question when it comes up, and that's not that often, people say, well, the question is, how do we make it easier for people who are self-employed or telecommuting to do this? Because, as you point out, the tax code isn't terribly equitable about this. There are benefits you can only get through employers. Our system is a little antiquated.
But before we get to that, though, this is a good thing for these people, right? I mean, they get to spend more time at home with their families. Presumably, they have a whole bunch more flexibility. I mean, this is a good development in the sort of world of work.
Well, I think it is, yes, because, you know, my contention would be that people working at home, everybody knows how hard it is to balance family and work and time and money. And, you know, here are a group of people who can, if they can figure out a way, spend more time around their children. They do errands. They show up, as I've shown up to your studio today, in khakis and a work shirt.
I'm, you know, wearing a double-breasted suit.
It's a beautiful four-point handkerchief, by the way.
Thank you very much.
And you know, they don't spend hours sitting in traffic, commuting. They're not polluting the environment. They're not wasting time. It's a good quality of life. And so, you know, there is this question about, okay, how do you help people who are already self-employed? And then there's another question, approach people take, which is to say, well, this isn't really the issue at all, because people who are self-employed, they make enough money, they'll figure out how to overcome these obstacles. The real question is, how do we keep workers from kicking people off their payrolls and trying to outsource workers, trying to force people into these situations? And I would suggest that I think there's a different question to ask, which is, how do we enable a wider group of people, more people with modest incomes, whom technology should theoretically be able to liberate at this point, to enjoy the benefits of this lifestyle in the 21st century? Because we have a notion of work, and that is that you get up and you get in your car and you drive to work and, kiss your kids goodbye, go to work, come home late, have dinner, etc. But that is a specifically 20th century industrial age way of looking at work. There are a number of people who will always probably work that way, but it doesn't have to be that way. And there are people who might make $50,000 or $75,000 a year who are working as
data entry people, actuaries,
computer programmers, reservations agents, anybody essentially who's not manufacturing or building something with their hands, who could be who could enjoy much greater flexibility and control over their lives as a result of technology and social change if we sat down and said, how do we create that workforce? How do we give more people? It seems to me there's a classist way in which we look at this, in which it's always about wealthier workers having all the opportunities to control their lives and everybody else being forced to go to work just as their fathers and their grandfathers did, you know, to the end of time.
Well, let's look at the reservations agent or the mid-level marketer or the data entry person. Why aren't companies amenable to this sort of arrangement? I mean, many do outsource this kind of work. What's the holdup here?
Right. Well, there's a, you know, to a certain extent, there's a market supply and demand here. Some people can negotiate telecommuting and better deals because their skill set is such, their value is such to their employer that that they can get that control. Some employers are more enlightened about it than others. But I think the essential problem here at the core, I'm not an economist, so I would be willing to have this debate with someone, but it seems to me the problem at the core here is that there's nothing in it for the employer right now. The employer is paying all this money and your benefits and your retirement and all this, and why should the employer go let you spend all your time on where you're not readily available to them, where you're not readily available to meetings, where they can't see that you're getting your work done or manage you in person, and they get nothing out of it? If, on the other hand, we had a sort of portable benefit system, if, on the other hand, we had a slate of programs, proposals from government that actually changed some of the system so that you could get a portable retirement program and portable health care, life insurance, disability insurance, so that it was possible for people of modest incomes to work for themselves, then I think you would see an exchange going on where employers would say, I'd be glad to get those costs off my books, and as long as you're getting your work done, that's a good trade for me. You go get control of your life, spend time with your kids, work at home, and I don't have to pay these these exorbitant and rising benefits costs.
As you pointed out in the piece, though, I mean, this is a tricky notion to sort of develop a political constituency behind this idea, because on the one hand, you'd have Democrats who would be loath to say, okay, let's offload the responsibility of healthcare, for example, and move away from a workplace-based healthcare system. On the other hand, you're talking about some kind of help from the federal government to make this possible, to have these portable plans, that's going to run afoul of sort of Republicans.
Right, and now you've just articulated the problem that we face across a whole range of issues in the political spectrum, which is polarized debate among people who are sort of coming at it from very 20th century positions in their ideological bunkers and who aren't willing to think differently about how government adapts and changes in the future. And that may well be a generational thing. As I've said many times, I'm not convinced that the sort of baby boomer generation of leaders has it in them, frankly, to get their heads around that kind of systemic change. We may be just waiting for a new generation of leaders who understand that the country is changing and the world is changing very dramatically under our feet.
We're talking to Matt Bai, who writes for the New York Times Magazine, about a new look of the American workforce. Do you work at home? Are you one of this growing group of untethered and unplugged workers? You can give us a call at 800-989-3255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And let's go to Jim, who's calling from Seattle, Washington. Hi, Jim.
Hello there. How are you today? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Our pleasure.
I have a comment. I work from home. I do a little bit of manufacturing and a lot of selling on eBay. And so I'm a self-employed person. And I just dislike the whole premise of trying to lay off more stuff onto the government. I mean, our taxes are high enough as it is, and our taxes should go for things like, roads and schools and infrastructure and stuff like that, not for paying for somebody's who made a personal choice not to work for somebody who can provide them health insurance and who sits at home and works. It's federalizing health care, and I totally disagree with it.
Okay, Jim. Well, the point's been put on the table. We appreciate it. What do you think, Matt? What do you say to Jim's argument?
First of all, Jim is part of a real growing class of people who do work at home and have flexibility. The eBay merchants, which is actually not a small group. I don't have the statistics, but it's a sizable community. I don't think, Jim, that at least as I don't envision it, I'm not the guy who sits down and designs policies, but I don't see why we would have to be talking about federalizing programs. I mean, let's look. Healthcare is a part of it, but I don't know that you have to federalize healthcare. I mean, every Democrat right now in the primaries is proposing some version of pooled plans of an individual mandate or something close to that where companies would compete and give individual plans. And you know, really, you know, when you look at some of the issues, one of the huge issues here we haven't discussed is the payroll tax, as I'm sure Jim knows. Mm. Basically, if you work for a traditional employment situation, you're paying about 7.5% of the payroll tax that covers entitlement programs. If you work for yourself, you're paying 15%. You know, there's an economic theory about this that it all evens out, but that's not how it generally feels to people or to employers. And in fact, that represents a huge obstacle for people of more moderate incomes who would take advantage of the situation. And that, you know, that payroll tax is just antiquated. And I don't think it would be federalizing any programs or asking government to take on any new huge costs to think about how you finance your entitlement programs differently and more equitably in a world where where we want to encourage people to have as much control over their lives and as much flexibility in their workplaces as possible.
Yes, but ultimately, what I hear you saying is it goes back to the two parts of our society that pay for everything, and that is the consumer and the taxpayer. And you're putting it back on businesses to, if I understood you correctly, to effectively pool some of their resources, which may or may not cost them more money, but if they have to pay even 1%, that is not directly impacting or affecting or helping their production, their company, their employees, that 1% is going to be passed on to the consumer.
Jim, we're going to pick up this point. We're going to just take a brief break, but I'm going to thank you and say goodbye to you for putting these ideas on the table. We're talking with Matt Bai right now, writer for the New York Times, about what he calls the new untethered workforce, the telecommuters, contract workers, consultants, and freelancers out there. If that includes you, give us a call, 800-989-8255. You can also reach us by email. The address is talk@npr.org. More about the downside of working at home in a moment. The head of the Freelancers Union joins us. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're talking about the growing number of people who work from home. They avoid that nasty commute in the morning and the office politics, but at a cost, including expensive health insurance and no retirement benefits. Matt Bai is with us. He covers politics for the New York Times Magazine. We have a link to his article on home office politics at npr.org/blog of the nation. If you work from home, give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-8255. And Matt Bai, just before the break, we were talking to listener Jim, who was making the point, expressing his concern that your idea, your proposal would somehow put a lot more pressure on employers and make it much more difficult for them.
Yeah, I totally understand what Jim is saying. I do think he's wrong about this. I mean, let's be clear, because I don't want to minimize this. There are a number of employers out there, large employers, who are trying to get benefits off their books and not pay any extra in the deal because they just want to cut overhead at the expense of their workers. And I understand why people resist that, and they ought to. But there are an awful lot of businesses out there, many more, I think, struggling legitimately with how to pay these costs of benefits, these rising costs of the 20th century social contract. And I think the reason that the environment around healthcare, for instance, has changed as it has, and why we are very likely to get some kind of healthcare program with the new administration, is because it's the businesses, it's the CEOs who are saying, look, we can't do this anymore. Government has got to step in and figure out a way to share the burden here. And so I don't think it's right that business would resist changes if they had to pay into a fund, for instance, to supplement health care for the uninsured, or if they had to fund. I think business is willing to come to the table and take part in a restructuring of some of these responsibilities we're talking about, because they understand that the old system is not so adaptable to the world we live in now and is actually costing them far more than a meaningful evolution would ultimately.
Well, if you're involved with running a business out there and you want to give us a call and chime in on this, call us now, 800-989-8255. And we're going to bring another voice into this conversation. One organization that represents independent workers is the Freelancers Union in New York. The group represents consultants, contractors, temps, and freelancers, and it's now the fourth biggest union in the state of New York. And we're joined now by its founder and executive director, Sarah Horowitz. She's with us from our bureau in New York. And Sarah, welcome. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks a lot.
Tell us a little bit about the Freelancers Union and what it does. How did you come up with the idea?
Well, first, it's a national organization. We have 60,000 members across the country. We started in New York. And what we've done is we've pioneered a new system for people to get health insurance and other benefits that stay with them as they go from job to job and project to project. And that has 16,000 people in New York and is spreading across the country. And really, it's because the reason for the need for this kind of organization, for this new union, is that the nature of work has completely changed. And it really is short term. People are just not working in the same traditional ways. And what we're seeing is that they're really falling out of the New Deal safety net. And if I can go back to something that Jim was saying,
sure.
There's a frustration because this is a third of the workforce. 10% are independent contractors and self-employed, 18% are part-time, 2+% are contract workers, and they have to pay out of their own pocket for health, retirement. They have to craft their own unemployment system, sick days. A lot of people feel like they're paying so much in taxes, yet they fall out of the New Deal and they get nothing for it. So really, what we have to be thinking about is let's not go back to the old ways of doing things. We don't only have to get benefits from the employer. We don't only have to get health insurance from the government. We could think about a new kind of system where people are joining together in mutual aid and getting the benefits of group purchasing and then getting benefits in terms of tax policy and other things to encourage these positive things. But this group really is going to be the pioneer of that whole creative process. This is going to be the group that's going to chart the next New Deal because they have real needs and they have a stake in creating such a plan.
But and Sarah, how do you sort of chime in on this discussion about the responsibilities of the employer, the responsibilities of government and the needs of the worker? I mean, in some ways we are talking about a new relationship between all three of those players, right?
Yes, and you know what I think is really interesting is if you go back to the 1930s, we said it was a discussion between business, government, and labor. And the problem is that now we're saying this is a discussion between business, government, and the individual. And we've forgotten that we're a democracy that works the best when people group together. We need to have a vibrant labor movement, unions, community groups, faith-based groups, and that they, when they get together and can be providing these kinds of services, can really provide a feedback loop to democracy. And that's what I think was really the most important point that Matt made in the New York Times article, is that we're really at a moment in time for something that's new and interesting and creative. And when we just talk about, is it going to be the employer? Is it going to be the government? We get back into an old way of talking about it, and that gets us into a polarized debate. Let's think of something fresh. Let's think of a new way of doing it. People can get together to solve their own problems. And by the way, this isn't just sort of the wealthy workforce. This crosses the economic spectrum. If you come to our website, freelancersunion.org, you can see there are 6,000 people who've already started putting their profiles up and see the kinds of work they do. They work from manufacturing, graphic design, programming, domestic childcare workers. This is something that's happening across the spectrum. And interestingly, 92% of this workforce is registered to vote. 90% have voted in national elections. They are, as Matt was saying, they're active in their communities. This is a group that's kind of chomping at the bit to really do something productive, not just with their professional lives, but really enhancing the democracy, too.
Let me read an email. This is Anna in California. I don't think companies need to see telecommuting as negative. I work for Boeing, which has a virtual office program, work from anywhere. I'm considered a full employee, and Boeing considers my willingness to work from home as a benefit to them. They save overhead costs because they do not have to supply me with an office. They also have found virtual workers get more done. We are more productive because we have less distraction, and that is not enough just to show up. Our work is results driven, and so both Boeing and I know what it takes to be successful. I've been a virtual worker for 4 years and love it. Boeing seems happy too. There's Anna, who's really talking about a more sort of traditional telecommuting role, Sarah. But I mean, this idea of this being a win-win for the worker and the company, that resonates with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that Anna's saying that I really hear, that I hear over and over again from thousands of independent workers, they take real pride in the work they do. It really matters to them to be excellent. And that's in part why they often leave the corporate sector, because they feel like there's such an attention to the bottom line that they have to skimp. And really what they want to do is their best work. And what's really interesting about them also is that this is a group that looks at work almost like a mixed portfolio. There's the work that people need to do to make the money, to pay their benefits, their rent, their mortgage, their kids' college, etc. And then there's the work they do that they just love. And so it's a harder way to go, because the income can be episodic, but it's a group of people who love what they do. And really, I think you can't think of a more entrepreneurial workforce, and that's very much what our country has always been about. But where we used to think of, you know, the pioneer, the woodsman going out west, what's very interesting is that it tends to be the creative class, the people who believe in the work they do. So we should be thinking about ways that support them. Let's start imagining an independent kind of benefit system where people can keep their benefits, they can join the different kinds of groups to get the benefits they need, so they don't have to just stay in a job that they hate. They have flexibility and mobility, but it's meaningful, and they're not bearing all the risk and all the cost, which is now what's happening increasingly on the part of government and the employer.
All right, well, let's try to get a couple of callers back into this conversation. Penny is calling from Oregon. Hi, Penny. You're on the air.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I'm a stay-at-home mom, and after I'd been a stay-at-home mom for about 10 years, I decided I needed to get back and work a little bit. My skills were so rusty that I couldn't find work in my old job, and so I took on a contracting job doing quality control for Google. The flexibility of it is fabulous. The weird part of it is I have never spoken to a person ever there. Everything we've done has been over email.
Interesting. Hmm. And Penny, what about benefits? What about the issue of health care and retirement? And is that being taken care of?
Well, I contractually can only work 20 hours a week, so that's not an issue for me. I would never qualify for them.
I see. But, I mean, is that an issue for you in terms of trying to support your family?
Luckily, I get my husband has benefits. But otherwise, yes, it would be a huge issue.
All right, Penny. Well, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Matt Bai, Penny was talking about not having contact with, sort of face-to-face contact with her workers. And I guess that's one of my questions to you. We were talking about this morning when we were all sitting around the editorial meeting and sort of saying, aren't we giving up something valuable in the workplace by not coming together?
You know, you hear that a lot from people who are used to traditional workplaces, and understandably. But if you look, you know, Mark Penn in his new book, the Democratic pollster, talks about the job satisfaction among self-employed or telecommuting workers is actually higher. They report higher job satisfaction than people who go to the office. I mean, I think they, you know, maybe in extreme cases they never speak to an individual, but I think in most cases, certainly in the magazine writers I know, they go out and they have lunch with people and they talk to folks and they have phone calls or video conferences. I don't think it needs to be a lonely pursuit. I think that's a natural fear. And, you know, as Sarah hit on something very interesting, when she talked about the woodsman, which I think is a very, very important point to keep in mind here. This notion we have of getting up in the morning in your suburban home, getting in your car, driving in a highway or whatever it is, or getting on a train and ending up at work, this is not written into the Constitution somewhere. In fact, it's kind of new. That came with the onset of the industrial age. And before that, you know, 75 years ago, before we got to that point in time, people worked at lived above their store or were farming to a large extent in the American economy. And this notion that you work somewhere else and then come home is not actually an integral part of the American experience. It actually may historically be recorded as an aberration of technology that came and went.
Interesting. Sarah Horowitz, do you agree with that?
Yes, in fact, it's very interesting. If you look at Abraham Lincoln's presidential campaign, he had to, in effect, apologize for being an employee and working for somebody as opposed to being a noble, self-employed person. But I want to get back, if it's okay, to something that Penny said. You know, what's really interesting about this workforce is that people really rely on their informal networks. And that's what is funny, is that we think that people that are in jobs are having these deep relationships and they lose that when they leave, but in effect it's replaced by something else, and that's the first thing any freelancer does. They join organizations, they start finding people, that's how they find work. Their word of mouth, their viral nature of the way they communicate is really another pretty inspiring thing. So I think it's a question of change and not loss, and I wonder if also it's a generational thing, that if you ask people who are like 20 to 35, the way they experience work is just very different from people who are, let's say, over 45. This is a loss often for people over 45 because of the episodic nature of work. But ask anybody graduating from college if they expect to be working for a company for 25 years, let alone 5 years, and they will just smile.
Hmm. Well, Sarah Horowitz, thanks so much for joining us today and adding your voice to this conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That's Sarah Horowitz. She's executive director of the Freelancers Union. She joined us today from our bureau in New York. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Doug, who's calling from Crossway, Virginia. Hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Hi. Actually, that's Crozet, Virginia.
Crozet. Sorry.
Yeah. I'm 36 years old, and I've been a pastor in the United Methodist Church for 10 years. And after 6 years of having an office and driving to work every day, I was sent to a rural appointment where I served three congregations at the same time, and my office was in the home. And that's we've done it that way for decades because a lot of our small churches needed a centrally located place for the pastor to work, and none of them really had room for an office, so we would work out of our homes, and we'd have a separate entrance and kind of our own little study in there. And, you know, looking at it from a work-life balance perspective, I couldn't wait to do it. I thought it would be wonderful. I would save all this money on gas, and I liked my little office, but my problem was that I never felt like I was off the clock. It was so hard for me, and especially at that time, you know, I had just become a father, and this may have been my own, you know, habits of really wanting to succeed and want to work very hard, but it was really hard for me to be mentally off the clock when I knew all I had to do was walk through one door and all the work and all the email and all of the thing, the phone calls and everything was sitting kind of right there waiting for me.
Sure, Doug, I think you put your finger on an interesting point. Matt Bynum, most of the work that I do from NPR is out of a home office. I found the same thing. It's very hard to just sort of shut the door at a certain time and say, that's it, I'm through with the job.
Yeah, I mean, Doug, you and I have a lot in common, actually. I don't know much about how you do your work, but I too have a small boy at home and do most of my work at home when I'm not traveling, certainly. And this is the great cost danger or the skill set you sort of need to develop working at home. It's very difficult because all these things that give us this tremendous mobility. I have a BlackBerry with me right now, and you know, we all have cell phones and internet and all of these video conferencing. All of these things that enable us to be mobile, to be anywhere and working. It's like I can go do errands and I can be working while I'm in the CVS, right? The problem is now I have to work when I'm in the CVS, and now people expect to be able to reach you all the time, and work does become quite onerous. And I think it's funny that employers tend to think, traditional employers, that if they send their employees home, they're not going to get their work done. They're not going to be manageable. I think the opposite is actually oftentimes the problem that Doug here has put his finger on, that it's employees figuring out how not to let this take over their lives and not working, you know, 15 or, you know, hours a day instead of 9 or 10. And so that is, I think that is one of the great challenges of a changing workforce. And ultimately, the responsibility falls on all of us to draw those lines and delineate. But as Doug points out, it can be awfully difficult.
Doug, go ahead, Doug. We have just a few seconds left.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Quickly, I feel like that some of my neighbors who are telecommuting, I think they work later at night than they probably would if they were in an office because they can. But I will say a colleague of mine dealt with this by his wife locking him out of the house one day a week and forcing him to go do something else, which apparently worked pretty well. So it's not a thing to do.
Let me say very quickly, too, Anthony. There is a good book that was done several years ago by a writer named Daniel Pink. It's Free Agent Nation, and he was one of the earliest people to put his finger on this trend. And so I do want to credit that and recommend it to people who are interested, too, because it gets into a lot of these trends and did so very early on.
Well, we have about 10 seconds left, but looking forward, I mean, a lot of these issues that we've been discussing in this hour, these are going to become more and more prevalent as we go forward, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. No, this isn't going away. And as I say, I mean, this is we're at this precipice, and it's not just on work. It's in a variety of issues across in our political dialogue where we're still having a fight about the way things were 20 years ago instead of thinking about where they're obviously going 20 years from now. And this is going to change governmental policies and our notion of work, whether we like it or not. There's no putting the genie back in the bottle.
All right, Matt Bai. Well, thanks so much for coming in today and talking about this.
Anytime. Thank you.
That's Matt Bai. He covers politics for the New York Times Magazine. He's also author of The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. He joined us here in Studio 3A. Thanks for being with us, Matt. I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up, new information this week on kids and ADHD. We'll take your questions and get answers from NPR's John Hamilton, 800-989-8255. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.